Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia via the web to the world. Well, this week the air is full of clichés. The Prime Minister wants us to look on the bright side. The Reserve Bank Governor suggests the glass is half full. Yet pessimism prevails. Is this part of a deeper withdrawal? Community participation in voluntary associations from churches to political parties and even service clubs is down. Yet without such social cement, how long can our institutions survive? Well, it's a pleasure to welcome into the studio this evening to discuss the issue and to take your calls a little later, the Reverend Dr. John Capper, Dean of the United Faculty of Theology in Melbourne, the Reverend Eleni Poulos of the Uniting Church Social Justice in Sydney, and on the phone from Canberra, the centre of our national activity, Dr. Keith Suter of Global Directions. Welcome to you all.
Good evening, John.
Thank you, John.
Good evening.
Keith Suter, let's come to you and make sure the phone's working okay. Are community associations and voluntary associations in trouble? Is there a change going on in civil society, and is it structural?
Yes, there certainly is a change. Whether they're in trouble, I guess, depends on how you define the nature of the change. The general feeling from American writers such as Robert Putnam is that you've got the decline of civil society. In other words, people don't join churches, rotaries, other religious groupings, or even political parties, as you said. And the figures certainly bear that out. On the other hand, you do get a lot of interest in local grassroots activities, and so you do get an expansion of local groups who don't want to be part of a broader institutional approach, but will turn up on the day if they feel like it. And I think it fits in with the generational change that's underway, that if you look at the what I call the Depression generation, those for whom the Depression of the 1930s was the thing that continues to colour their lives, so they collect plastic bags, elastic bands, because you never know when they're going to come in handy. Those people are the ones who were used to large organisations. They were in the services during the war or in auxiliary organisations. They worked in large bureaucracies after the war. And they're the ones who represent the backbone of a lot of our established non-governmental organizations. You get the baby boomers coming along. In other words, the people born after 1946 and for about 20 years, the largest single age cohort in the Western world. You get some of those people joining, but not that many, but at least they do keep the numbers up. What is significant is that younger people, the Gen X's, the Gen Y's, millennials, etc., are not willing to make the same commitment day in, day out, to go to committee meetings, plow through agendas, do minutes of meetings, etc. These are people who have an instant approach to life. They will turn up if they feel like it. They'll put a lot of energy in. They're very idealistic, but they're not heavily into supporting the institutions. So they're very purpose-oriented rather than process-oriented.
Well, we might explore that and some other things a little later on, but you seem to be suggesting that this isn't just a cyclical shift, that there is a real structural shift going on in the way we relate to our social and civic institutions.
Absolutely. Indeed, I've devised a diagnostic test that I work privately with non-governmental organisations to help them to see whether or not they do actually have a future. One of the problems is that a lot of organisations are unwilling to confront the future, and they will continue to limp along, actually hemorrhaging the funds and gradually contracting, getting smaller and smaller. And the leaders are often being quite misleading in their projections about how they expect a revival to come around the corner, etc.
Let me bring one of our other guests into the conversation at this stage, and we'll pick up the threads of that. Eleni Poulos, let me bring you into the conversation as somebody who's committed to the Uniting Church, particularly its engagement with the world and the things that are going on in the world. If there is a structural shift going on, as Keith says, and I'll get your observations as to whether you think that's true in terms of the church, what does this do for organisations and movements such as churches, which have built their whole life on people giving a total commitment? That is, you sign up for life. You commit yourself as a Christian to I don't know, the Methodist Church is not here anymore, so we can safely use the Methodist Church. So what do you do in that circumstance? So first of all, do you essentially support what Keith's saying? And how does it manifest itself in the church?
I think Keith's right. I think there are deep structural changes going on. They've been happening for a long time. They relate to things like, I think, the growth of individualism, I think consumerism, the way that people are used to relating to each other changes, the places where we gather. If you look at the influence of shopping malls, for example, they have become privatised social hubs. That can be a matter of concern. It's a matter of concern for me. But
churches don't appear in them.
No, although you do have churches in the middle of sort of urban hubs. You think of the church in the marketplace in Bondi Junction, stuff like that. And this is one of the places where churches, I think, are rising to the challenge, and that is that they're actually connecting in quite unique localised settings, and they're adapting themselves to be reflective of local communities, to reach out to the people in their local communities and to offer ways for local members to connect.
We'll get onto that a little later, but just on the second part of that observation with regard to Keith, that it has had a profound effect on churches, and churches do not seem, certainly from the 1970s to the present, to have been able to adapt, in that there's been a precipitous decline in participation in church life.
It's a big challenge for churches, and I think, you know, there's been a lot of time and money spent trying to reverse the trend, you know, but we talk about bums on pews in churches. But the flip side of that is that this is an opportunity to actually live out the Christian mission in very different ways. And I'm very pleased that there are so many parts of the Uniting Church around the country that are rising to that challenge. But it's a very different future we face. I don't think it's one that we need to be afraid of. I think the church is actually more about the mission and the service and the community that it is about institutions and structures. I'm not young enough to be Gen X or Gen Y, but I kind of get them in that.
John Kappa, let me bring you in here. You're somebody who is a theological educator. You're in contact with young people all the time. You've seen changes going on in church communities generally and in society generally. What are your brief observations and perhaps concerns?
Well, John, firstly, I'd like to be the token millennial. Is that okay?
Yes.
Yeah, that's not going to work, is it? But there's certainly change. There's no doubt about it. But a society is more than the sum of its institutions. Each of us bring individually into the society part of our lives and our sharing and our vision. And in many cases, it seems to me that we have people looking beyond the institutions because their sense of faith, their sense of belonging, their sense of community is not so much shaped by the institution. It may be shaped through the institution. The institution may have some contribution. But there are some interesting factors going on. I hear regularly the comment about decline in church attendances, and there's no doubt that that's true. But the reality is that two or three factors have changed. One is, these days, regular church attendance is not twice or three times on a Sunday as it was when I was a youngster. It's now once a month or once a fortnight. So the number of people who are engaged in the life of church communities is still reasonably high. Secondly, there's a large number of Christian communities that connect no longer in official formal church buildings. So we talk about the shopping malls, but there are quite a number of churches that gather in theatres, in shopping malls on Sunday mornings when no one else uses them. But there are others who meet, you know, Wednesday night, when the place is fairly quiet. Our local shopping centre where I am has a chapel in it. And it's interesting to see that sense of community engagement. It's been that way for a while. So there are some interesting changes in the way people connect. And you mentioned my involvement in theological education, John. A recent government report on higher ed suggested, somewhat surprising to many of us in the sector, that they consider that theological education is a likely growth area in higher ed. And it's partly because people are wanting to explore these issues of faith. They're not necessarily doing it by attending church regularly. They're involved in conversations, they research on the net, they undertake formal studies. So there are significant changes in the way that we engage as a community.
Let's talk about some of the causes of this disengagement. Keith mentioned a few, but both the causes and the impact on social institutions unless the institutions can adapt. For example, some have suggested that kids these days, or younger people, are more interested in contractual relationships. That's in not just a shallow what's in it for me, but I'll be engaged for a limited time, provided certain goals are reached. It's very goal-oriented. What does that do for those institutions that depend for their long-term survival on the ongoing commitment of those, and we can all think of them, if those of you who went to church in your youth, those people who kept the church doors open, come hail or shine, for year after year, the faithful stewards, if you like. And it appears that it's those people that Keith indicated are disappearing.
In my talks, John, on church growth, I use the comment that the families that keep the church doors open are often the families that keep the church pews empty. Yes. In other words, you're right, they are there keeping the doors open, but they are very fixed in their way, so they might end up with young people turning up who want a different liturgy, different times of service, etc., and the old-timers will say, no, that just won't work. So there are problems with how you handle the process of change, and I think I speak as a member of the Uniting Church from the very outset. I was the one who actually organized the first procession back in 1977 for the Uniting Church. And what has struck me over the decades is the Uniting Church has handled the process of change extremely badly, and we have not found ways of being able to engage our members in a variety of ways in which they do need to be engaged. There are real problems here, because if you're going to bring on a major change within a big private for-profit corporation, you've always got that element of the salary hanging over the members. The problem with the Uniting Church is that you can put on seminars about how we want to make changes, but if people aren't interested, they just don't turn up. There's no way that you can go out there and reprimand them for not turning up and listening to all the sorts of new ideas. And in fact, for me, the tragedy with the Uniting Church has been this decline and the lack of honesty of the major church figures in identifying the change, and also in alerting the members the fact that they will just need to do church differently. I think they're just smoothing the pillow of a dying race.
Interesting reflection, Keith. I mean, the folk that you mentioned are not called pillars of the church because of their flexibility, are they?
But what do you do? I mean, it'd be fine to have lots of kids turning up, but if there's nobody there to say, look, this is the way the organisation works, this is the way we fit it in, this is the way we do this, this is the way we are connected locally and globally and we maintain the institutions, if there's no structure there, and I don't mean a physical structure necessarily, what do you do?
Well, John, I do want to note that there are some significant events running around the place which attract large numbers of people, and they are, in that sense, the gathering of a large crowd for a shorter time rather than the regular gathering of a group. So the sense of what church is, I think, has changed from simply local gathered community to sometimes larger gathered conference or event, or sometimes mission. Sometimes the issues of justice and welfare attract people around them as well. So the sense of what it means to be engaged has changed. The internet's a part of that as well. The nature of friendship, the nature of longevity, the nature of how things are transacted between people, much more is less visible now than it once was.
Look, I think Keith's right, but I don't think that's the whole story. I think in the Uniting Church, maybe we haven't done it so well. Maybe it's crunch time now, and what we're actually seeing is churches and groups of church members, I think, rising to the challenge to find new ways of serving and therefore new ways of engaging people. And I think for the church, what's critical is that we don't do engagement for engagement's sake. We actually engage with people in our communities and engage on issues of justice, because that is our mission. And I'm pretty optimistic that what we need to do is do our mission well. We need to serve, we need to stand up for justice, we need to take note and care for and respect the people who are around us and open up our doors and engage with them where they're at, and things will change. And we can see this in one of the most exciting things that I've seen happening in the church lately is the number of uniting churches in their local communities who are beginning community gardens, and they're inviting members of the community to come on board and be a part of that. That does both community building, it increases social cohesion, and it actually gives people an opportunity to make a difference to the way that our economy works at a very local level. So those sorts of things are happening and they are exciting. We need more of them.
Let me shift the gear of the conversation just for a moment and get you all, as people who've been actively involved in social institutions like churches for years, to put yourself outside of that and look at political parties, say, or trade unions, or service clubs, and you see the same thing happening there. What do you say to them? What do you say to them, John Capper, as somebody who's been interested in and how people join and attend and keep attending and participate for a long period of time? If you're looking, you know, as somebody with the wisdom of seeing it go through the church as an institution, what do you say to political parties and trade unions?
Yeah, and even service clubs, John. Yeah. I think those groups are similar. I think one of the dilemmas I've noted in my engagement with those sort of groups and with the church is that the danger we all seem to fall into, our default position, is that the structure and the organisation is what matters. Now, organisations do not begin because someone wants an organisation. They begin because someone's got a vision and a purpose. And typically, two or three generations down the track, it may be a century, I think the time frame is reducing considerably at the moment. People lose sense of what that vision is, why they have the organisation, and the focus becomes on maintaining the organisation. If we draw the parallel from the church, Jesus did not draw people so that they would gather in buildings to worship him. He gathered them because he wanted to see the world changed, and because there was a vision from God for that. And similarly, let's take one of the political parties whose background is in organised union movement, which has its roots in Methodism in broad ways. That came about to protect the workers and to care for them. Now, that's become a political force. It's absolutely fascinating historically. But initially, the purpose was not membership of the party. It was the transformation of society. And the same can go as we look at welfare organisations. These days, the danger in our welfare organisations is that there's a lot of effort spent on writing submissions to government to gain funding to do good things, which may align with the purposes of the welfare mission originally, but which may not too. The risk is that they're driven by factors other than their vision. And my conversation with those groups is to keep asking the question, what is our vision? What is our plan? Why are we here? And if the answer is simply to maintain the infrastructure, then my suggestion is let's pack it up, give it to someone, if there are resources involved, who can do something better and achieve the vision.
Keith Suter.
Well, I work with those types of organisations, and there is an edifice complex involved. And people simply will not willingly accept that they are coming to the end of their existence. They are in a state of denial, and they are not willing to share their resources with alternative organisations. So what you see is that they gradually hemorrhage to death because they don't wind themselves up. The money just trickles away. One of the issues I raise with them is the need to have appropriate exit strategies and also to be able to safeguard their assets. A good example of this is one that I've worked with publicly, so I'm not revealing anything I shouldn't. The Women's Christian Temperance Union in Sydney has basically run out of new members. So its current membership is very old. And Bernice Cardwell, the last president, encouraged her colleagues to wind the organisation up, sell their assets, which come to almost $1 million in real estate, and people, as they die, continue to leave money to WCTU. And we're now in the process of creating a trust fund which will then finance anti-alcohol activities. Indeed, I'm one of the trustees of that new fund which is being established. Now, I regard WCTU as a classic example of what to be done. In other words, you have a leader who can see the writing is on the wall, who doesn't want to have, in this case, her assets in her organisation just hemorrhage away, came up with a clear strategy about what they do next, WCTU continues to exist. In other words, you continue to follow the original vision of your founder, but you use different methods. And that's the big thing. But I can tell you, I've worked with a number of other organizations that I won't identify who just simply have been unwilling to do that. And they've ushered me out of the room as quickly as possible. And later on, of course, I found out that they've later just bled to death and they've wasted all their assets.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. John Cleary with you. Our guests this evening, the Reverend Dr. John Kappa, the Reverend Eleni Poulos and Dr. Keith Suter, and we're discussing membership in clubs, societies, churches and other organisations. Why has there been a precipitate decline? What's going on? Is there a generational change? If there is, does it matter? And what's going to happen to those organisations that can continue to struggle to remain relevant? Let's talk about a couple of other things before we take your calls on 1300 800 222. If you want to give us a call on your club or society, or whether you participated and whether you stopped, another couple of issues that may be relevant. People these days generally don't like authoritarian structures. They don't like finger wagging. They don't like structures that say, we are the leaders of this structure and we're telling you in the congregations or in the pews or wherever else what to do. At the same time, you have other changes too, like many organisations and associations have to be more rigorous because they're being told by government, sorry, no, you need to impose criteria and standards on members because members are dealing with children, members are dealing with other things. So these factors that are relevant also, Keith Suter?
Absolutely. It's always difficult to get treasurers because after all, you're not being paid. But it's even more difficult when you look at all the new paperwork that's involved. Well-meaning lawyers here in Canberra, which is where dreams come to die, well-meaning lawyers are destroying non-governmental organisations through all the excessive paperwork, all the police checks that need to be carried out, etc. They all mean well, but in fact they're just making the life of non-governmental organisations very difficult, because particularly if you are providing services to the government will not provide money to you to cover all the additional regulations which you have to meet on their behalf. So they're actually killing non-governmental organisations, and the non-governmental organisations, churches, the welfare groups within them, etc., are all busy trying to maintain their existence, but it is actually very difficult. And I think eventually, particularly with all the new changes that are happening, and that's a warning that I give when I'm giving talks to non-governmental organisations, be very careful about being a director of an organisation, because increasingly the only difference between a non-governmental organisation and a for-profit company is what you do with your surplus, because all of the onerous director obligations that now exist will also apply to non-governmental organisations. And so there is a real risk, I think, even for churches with their complicated structures, etc., the way things are going, ultimately we're going to end up with, as we've seen with some of the other big secular firms and their problems, we will end up with similar ones occurring within churches and other and within the general non-governmental organisations. Anybody being a director of a voluntary organisation probably needs to get their head examined.
All right, we've dealt with the structural stuff.
I'm with you. I know that Keith is also, as I am, a member of the Australian Institute of Company Directors, and I think the fear is that we've moved into a regime socially which is risk-averse. And whilst we ought to be cautious, I think, as responsible citizens about subjecting others to risk or our organisations to risk such that they might lose their identity or lose their focus, one of the realities, at least for Christians, is that if you look at Jesus, if you applied a risk management regime onto his life and ministry, we would know nothing about it. It wasn't about, you know, ridiculous embracing of stupid risks, but it was recognising that if good things are going to happen, people need to stand up and be counted and to be out there and to make a noise about it. And I think one of the challenges for us socially as we restructure is to find ways of having smaller numbers of directors managing more processes that are event-related in a community. In that sense, doing things like pooling the public liability insurance risk that we need, yeah, which individually we couldn't manage, but corporately we can, and to use our networks well so that good things can happen in society. It's sort of flash mobbing processes of engaging the society on on matters that are significant rather than simply being obsessed with the governance and the structure itself.
Is it also a matter, Eleni Pillos, of sensibility too, that people don't like to have fingers wagged at them anymore from the pulpit? They're perfectly entitled to say, look, I know as much about you as this issue about as you do, Your Reverend Sir, and I'm not going to be told by you.
I think it's true. People don't like to have fingers being waved at them. But... you know, it is about engaging with people with integrity. And I think what we've been talking about a lot tonight is around, you know, powers and structures and, you know, people in power trying to maintain the institutions that have given them the power in the first place. When you've got public engagement breaking open the way that it has, when you've got social media, that gives access to so much information and so many new and different ways of engaging in the issues that give you passion, then it's a whole different ball game. And I think for churches, what we've been talking about is quite right. There is a line we have to manage very carefully between appropriate levels of accountability and not being so risk averse that we actually forget why we're here, which is to serve the most vulnerable and to stand up for justice in this place and to draw people together to work for the common good.
One other comment briefly from you all before we take calls on 1300 800 222, and that is the role of churches as agents in civil society, the way clubs and societies are, in that historically they've given people the basic training and the skills about how to participate in society, how to run meetings, how to do those sorts of things that allow people to get into politics, build the skills that enable them to run civil society. Keith Souter, is civil society going to need to pay careful attention to what's going on here?
Yes, I think it is. And I think that there are warnings, I think, for the broader groups such as environment movements, etc. The great value of churches is simply our stored up resources. Most of the other organizations are comparatively newcomers. They don't have the asset base of the churches. The churches are able to live off that. They can do the Christian training, they can do the welfare services, but eventually those assets will start to run down. And even being involved in churches in a small way is very good for youngsters to get a feel for how they do conduct themselves in public, etc. So the churches are good training grounds, and as John has pointed out, that the Labour movement in the United Kingdom and in Australia is heavily indebted back to the Methodist Church. So there are very important implications, I think, for the broader civil society movement about what's going on in the churches, because after all, the churches are the oldest and largest non-governmental organisations within Western society. And it's interesting to see the growth of the churches in Africa and Latin America, South Korea. That's where the growth is now. And so they are playing a very useful role on issues within their own society. So the momentum is continuing. I guess my comment would be, let us not get too depressed about the state of the church globally by what we see here in Australia, because elsewhere it's growing very rapidly. For example, of the seven of the largest churches in the world, 10 largest churches in the world, seven are in South Korea. So South Korea is powering ahead, Africa's powering ahead, India, China, etc. So let's not get too depressed, John, about what we're seeing here.
Well, no, I'm more concerned in this question about the general state of our own civil society and whether or not the collapse of membership and participation generally should ring alarm bells. John Capper for civil society.
John, you're right in that the church has been a training ground for leadership and for shared vision, camaraderie and so on. I think we see that in other ways. Certainly the nature of friendship has changed in the nature of the internet, for instance. The telephone did the same a generation earlier. One of the things that does please me is to see the extent to which schools are encouraging the basic skill sets of leadership in class captains, school captains. They've been around for a long time, and a lot of people have learned a lot about leadership by being a member of the Student Representative Council, or whatever the equivalent body is. Now, if we continue to have the bulk of our populace go to school and the bulk continue till 18 years of age or thereabouts. There's certainly a fair bit of scope in that context. And the number of schools that I'm aware of now doing things from their student base, which once would have been done by churches, the Oak Tree Foundation that started here in Melbourne, for instance, which has captivated the vision of a lot of schools and has brought them into involvement in areas of justice. The fair trade discussions that school children are having and organising events. I think we're not lacking that sort of leadership. I think the nature of the institutions in which it's happening are different, but I think that short-term focused organisational approaches will help us.
You're on Sunday night. Time to take your calls. Let's say hi to Derek in Ipswich in Queensland. Derek, thank you for joining us. Derek, are you there? Yeah, g'day.
I think this is a very good topic because, unlike some of your comrades there, I think the malaise in church participation and general public volunteering, there's a correlation. But going back to the church, I think people are no longer prepared to, what they used to say, pray, pay and obey, and just put up with all the BS that the clergy used to shove down our necks. I'm a Catholic, and we had Vatican II. Now we're being told it was a mass hallucination. You know, Vatican II didn't exist, and get back into the confessional box. And things like we just saw this weekend, the New South Wales Anglican and Catholic Church instructed their clergy to tell from the pulpit that the church doesn't tolerate same-sex marriage. I mean, people in that congregation are going to walk away and say, I'm not going to belong to a church that's homophobic.
And this goes back to that broader question of finger wagging when people's sensitivities on a whole range of issues are nuanced by their own reading of the Bible or their own understanding of the Christian faith. Eleni, this makes the job of clergy, if you want to say it, far more complex, doesn't it?
Look, it does, and it makes the task of educating our church leaders particularly important. I mean, well, one of the things that's important for us in the Uniting Church, in the education and training of our ministers and in the living out of a person's ministry, is that people are expected to carry the identity of the Uniting Church with them, and that's part of the ministry of an ordained person. So the challenge is to be clear about who we are, for example, as Uniting Church. What does our history say to us? What does our tradition say to us? How do we live our life in Australia in the 21st century, and what do we bring with us into this new space? What of our history do we bring with us?
John Capper, do churches have to be very careful? This issue of gay marriage is, I think, one that's very interesting because the splits on it seem almost generational, yet that's at a cultural level, even within churches, yet the authority structures of churches say, no, there is a clear line here. And for historic denominations, this has become a real test of the very sorts of things we're talking about.
John, there's a serious danger that the churches that are most outspoken on issues around human sexuality are the ones that have actually driven away the folk they might be most concerned to engage with, and it seems to me that is a great tragedy. The fundamental mistake, I think, that's made by Christians claiming, maybe there are two fundamental mistakes, that they speak for the society is, firstly, to assume that the scriptures speak into our situation rather than to understand their situation and to engage ours and to appreciate ours sensibly. The bigger philosophical one is a hangover of a Christendom mentality where the church claimed to speak on behalf of and to be the only authoritative voice in a society. And it seems to me that the challenge now for Christians is to ask, is the Christian ethic for Christians, or is it something that Christians are obliged to either model at the mildest or encourage slightly more strongly, or at the most extreme, which we hear from some context, to inflict on society? And I think the question of the nature of the relationship of Christian faith and the broader community is one that needs examination in many quarters. I can give you my own sense of that. But it seems to me that as Christians, we ought to be looking at the questions of justice, the questions of appropriateness, the questions of concern and care, rather than being salt and light by over-salinating the whole of our country and being light in the sense that insists on shining a searchlight where people are not interested in being seen.
Derek, thanks for your call. We will move on. We've got a few calls on the board, so we'll try and get through as many as possible. To Bill in Cape York. Bill, welcome to you. How are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Terrific. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, that's good, yes. I was just taking a bit of an interest in your program about saying before why so many people are leaving the churches and the political parties and wrapping themselves up in cocoons, perhaps. Maybe it's because they feel so hopelessly disenfranchised and that they don't have a say in anything much anymore. I think that's probably a lot of the problem. Their opinions don't seem to count. And I think you'll find that, I myself am a member of a political party, but only recently, because I felt we need to stand up and do something about what's happening. And you've already covered a couple of those subjects, but we've got television since the 70s and videos and DVDs and all the other canned entertainment. You know, people don't take an interest as much as they should anymore.
Yes, well, an episode of CSI may be a little more encouraging than hearing the minutes read at the local Labor Party branch meeting for the 47th time.
Well, of course, and that's the problem. I mean, the people get their chance of democracy once every 3 years for 5 minutes when they vote, and after that, it's all gone out the door. Mm. Their voice counts no more, as is evidence of what's happening in Canberra today. I mean, look at the things that are going on there that nobody wants anything to do with but can't do anything about.
Mm. Keith Souter.
Well, I think that's right. The people who run the country don't stand for election. And I think that Australians are getting smarter and smarter in realising just how peripheral the events here in Canberra are for the broader trends within society. A lot of our economic destiny is tied up in the boardrooms of big corporations or overseas corporations. I agree with what Bill is saying. There is this general sense of despair within Australia, and people are just focusing on what they can actually do something about, which is raising the children, etc., and doing something locally rather than trying to get involved in some of those bigger issues. Because clearly, obviously, whatever, you know, we've now, as we speak, the G20 are preparing to meet in Mexico. These are the leaders of the biggest 20 economies in the world, and yet they will have very little influence on any of the issues that they're going to be discussing. So we're moving into a world of greater decentralization, fragmentation, and a lot of the power being done behind the scenes and not necessarily involving the people who think they're running the country.
And you've got Rio 20 Plus happening this week as well.
Yeah. Mm.
Which is the Earth Summit, whose noble ideals have fallen by the wayside. Bill in Cape York, thank you so much for your observations. We do need to move on. Raymond is on a mobile. Hello, Raymond. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, great. What would you like to say?
Just listening about how you're talking about how the church is declining and there's numbers. I think it resorts directly back to good teaching and making Jesus the centre of the church, making him the cornerstone. And I think that maybe with other liberal churches where they've allowed maybe the fallibility of the Gospels, they've let that go, that inconsistency that exists inside those denominations aren't exactly the best witness for what the actual gospel stands for. Hmm. So, I think the comments that are made that the church may have lost touch socially in some ways are true, and that's due to maybe some insecurity or just being devalued, as some person mentioned before. But I think that it's purely a thing where we need to get back to that you need a relationship with Jesus and you're saved by grace and grace alone.
John Capper, your observations.
Yeah, look, I appreciate Raymond's call back to that core sense of what it means to be Christian. And I think that one of the dangers for us is that we get caught up in theological issues. What is the greatest witness in our society is a changed life, someone with a passion who once didn't have a passion, someone with a focus and a hope who once didn't. I'm reminded that Jesus commented to his followers that what would indicate that they were his disciples to others was not their church attendance, not their giving, not their passion for anything, but their love for others. And that's the thing that indicates change in an individual's life and that brings change in societies. I think both Bill and Derek also pointed out the danger of a dominating leadership that doesn't give people that space to be who they're called to be and to live it out, to discover it. That's the great offer that Jesus gives, and it's what I'm sure shapes what Christians seek to do and what churches seek to enable them to do.
Eleni.
Yes. Oh, I appreciate that comment. I think one of the gifts that we gain from scriptures and from the life of Jesus is a passion for the diversity of creation and the diversity of humankind. And I think in churches like the Uniting Church, although some parts of us are not looking very healthy at all, other parts are looking extremely healthy. The multicultural parts of our church, in some places there are sort of very vibrant young congregations. What I think that speaks to is the value that people put on being able to enter a church and a community where it's safe to hold a diversity of views. And I know for the Uniting Church, this is both one of its greatest struggles, but I think also one of its greatest achievements.
Let's go to Jerry in Perth. Hello, Jerry. Welcome.
Oh, good evening. And what a tremendous show you've got on here tonight. It's a lot of the things that I'm thinking, or perhaps I could have said, has already been stated. So I'll perhaps just throw a couple of thoughts to you. I'm basically talking about, when I say church here, my experience comes from the Catholic Church, from being brought up Catholic educated and you know, born and bred into the Catholic Church type of thing. But what I believe now is happening, and I'm quite sad, but in some ways I'm very excited, and I probably won't be around. I'll be in my grave before this happens. But I think the present Roman Church is coming from a point of view of power over people, rather than enabling people and empowering people. They're pushing them away with all more rules, more regulations. And I think what's happening, in fact, it's already happening within certain pockets of the church, from the Catholic Church that I'm talking about now, that there are these these new springs, new communities that are fighting against this. I don't think people need to have any more of this stuff pushed down their neck anymore. And I think I'll just finish here because I feel I'm waffling on a bit, but the church is perhaps going to self-implode, and then something new and exciting is going to come forward. And I hope I'm around to see a little bit of that.
John Capper.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks so much for that, Jerry. I'm with you. Not being anti-institutional, but if the institution takes over and dominates, we've got a problem. The retirement of Bishop, Pat Power of Canberra recently just points to his concern that there's a danger that the institutions don't serve the needs and the passions of those whom Jesus has called. And the comments earlier, by the way, Keith, you talk about, you know, keeping things going forever. It is odd that as Christians who believe in the resurrection, sometimes we're a bit afraid of letting things die. And no one would hope for the destruction of organisations. But recognising that God brings new possibilities out of old failures is fantastic at the individual level and at the organisational level. So I too look to that day of renewal and see patches of it, by the way. I work with a Catholic Uniting Anglican network of teachers who also include amongst them Baptists and Lutherans and have students from all over the place. And to see the possibilities that are coming out of those renewed lives and of organisations that have said, this is no longer working, let's do something new. It's very exciting, as Eleni noted to us.
Could I ask you all a brief comment, because we've only got 3 or 4 minutes left, on one perhaps optimistic spin on this? We've been talking about institutions, and we've been dwelling, probably appropriately, on some of the negative aspects of institutions. Yet it remains true at the moment that churches are one of the few coherent global multinational organisations concerned basically with value, and that surely at this particular time that has to be seen as potentially a major, major advantage, that the questions of value can be articulated at a global level when so much else is dominated by, as Keith indicated, multinational business corporations. Here you have the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, that still have global structures associated with them. Many other churches do. I just pick out those two. Here is not an opportunity, surely, for an optimistic view of the capacity of community organisations. Keith Souter.
Yes, well, as you know, I'm doing my next doctorate is actually on the future of the Uniting Church. And one of the areas I'm looking at is the role of the emerging church within the Uniting Church. A whole literature is there that it doesn't get too much coverage, but it's quite amazing what is going on, all the books that are being written, the ideas that are coming, not just within Uniting Church, but other churches as well. So you're quite right, and Phyllis Sillick in her recent book is also talking about a whole new church emerging, but it's going to be different, and we've got to be willing to make that transition across to a new type of way of doing church.
Eleni.
Yes, John, you're quite right. Internationally, I think that the faith-based organisations have played and continue to play a really important role in upholding values that serve the common good. It is not about our institutions, though. It's about the narrative that we have, that narrative of the gospel that actually gives our advocacy for justice both locally, nationally and internationally, a value to the world.
Oh yes, but the narrative is contained within institutions, particularly when it comes to actually, you know, getting on as a UN subcommittee or an NGO or whatever. I mean, the messy mechanics are still there.
The mechanics is there, and it's very helpful, John. There's no doubt about that.
John Capper.
Yeah, the mechanics, there's no doubt about it. We need some structures, but to recognise that as Jesus breaks out of the grave, so the Christian faith, and in fact God's work in the world, breaks outside of its structures as well. And one of the great challenges for us, I think, is to be life-affirming rather than life-denying, to recognise that certainly what Jesus does is not to heal everybody, but to affirm the humanity of everybody with whom he engages. I was delighted recently to be at the first graduation of MCD University of Divinity, Australia's first specialist university, of which the United Faculty is a part, and to hear the Vice-Chancellor of Sydney University say, "We excluded you when we were founded, you people in theology, because you were so divided. Now we look at ourselves and we're divided, and you're showing us how to do unity in your diversity." That's pretty exciting, and it points to what we can do.
Reverend Dr. John Capper, thank you so much for joining us. Reverend Eleni Poulos and Dr. Keith Souter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For all of you who've participated on the phone too, sorry we couldn't get through to all of you on Sunday night. Back shortly. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.